And now, from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics and CNN Audio, The Axe Files, with your host, David Axelrod.
It wasn't that long ago that Arizona Senator Mark Kelly saw his future as a husband, a father, an astronaut, and Navy officer. But the tragic assassination attempt in 2011 on his wife, Congresswoman Gabby Giffords, set Kelly on a different course. I spoke with Senator Kelly last week about his journey, his heroic wife, and the many issues from Ukraine to drought in the Southwest, on which he's playing a central role in the Senate today. Senator, great to see you. It's been a while, and it caused me to think about the first time that we met, and you probably don't remember this, but I do, because you weren't a senator, you weren't a politician, you were accompanying your wife, Gabby Giffords, at a White House reception in 2009, probably, maybe 2010, and you were in your dress, Navy uniform, and she proudly introduced you to me. And I was thinking back to that because so much has changed.
Yeah, in those years. Yeah, it's been 14 years.
And I was thinking about the fact that at the time that I met you, you were an astronaut.
Mm-hmm.
And she was a star.
Yes.
She was a star politician. She was someone who people spoke of as, here's a future senator. You know, here's maybe one of the future national women to break the glass ceiling in national politics and so on. And here you are, United States Senator now. You're sitting in the seat that everybody thought she would be sitting in. She's a remarkable leader.
Right. Or in the other one. I mean, when you think about when she was, you know, shot on that day, soon after that, she was planning on having a meeting about, potentially running for the United States Senate in the seat formerly held by John Kyle.
Mm-hmm.
And not realizing that months later, after she was injured, he decided not to run for re-election. So it was going to be, would have been an open seat. So
yeah.
I'm fully aware. And
I mean, that must be strange for you. I mean, you probably don't have time to stop and think about
it. No, I think about it all the time. All the time. I mean, Gabby was really, really good at this job.
Yeah.
Being a member of Congress, she loved the job. I don't hear that from a lot of members of Congress. And she would have run for the United States Senate. And as Jeff Flake, once said, Jeff said, and I think he said this publicly, he said, Gabby Giffords would have beaten me like a borrowed mule. And
yeah.
Jeff is such a good friend of hers and of mine.
Yeah,
and he's doing a fabulous job as the ambassador to Turkey. So I'm convinced she would have been in the United States Senate. And, sometimes I think to myself, if something would have happened to me, if I was the person who would have been injured, would Gabby have become an astronaut?
Yeah.
She says yes.
On the way over here, I was listening to CNN on the radio, and they were reporting on, and I can't even remember where it was from, but some young man with an AR-15 was shooting out his front door and several people were killed, shooting at motorists driving by. Ultimately ran out in the street with handguns and took off his body armor and basically was beckoning the police to kill him. I mean, it was what they call suicide by police. Yeah. But these things seem to be happening all the time. And so my first question isn't about the policy issues.
Mm-hmm.
My first question is, when these things happen, when you hear these things, does it take you back in time to that moment when this surreal thing happened to you that nobody ever expects to happen to them?
Many of them do. And that's right. We don't expect it to happen to us or our family members. And then in so many cases, it does. I remember in January 2011, getting this call from Gabby's chief of staff to tell me that Gabby, and I'd just gotten off the phone with my wife. And then she told me that Gabby's been shot and, we don't think it's going to be, just the way at least as an optimist, my mind works is, okay, she was probably shot in the arm. Hung up from that call, get a call back, about 10 minutes later, and where she tells me she's been shot in the head. And at that point, I knew our lives were going to be dramatically different. and change forever. And on the airplane ride out there, you know, media essentially pronounced her dead for about 30 minutes.
I remember, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And I knew that this, you know, Gabby's life, my life, were forever changed by this.
I watched that wonderful documentary that was released last year called Gabby Giffords Won't Back Down. And in it, there was a lot about that.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that was moving to me was your young daughters. Mm-hmm. You had daughters from a previous marriage. Mm-hmm. They hadn't grown particularly close to Gabby by their own admission. They said it was the first and only time that they saw you cry.
Right.
And, but
it was on the plane. Yeah.
But the other thing that they said was that this drew you all closer.
And them to her, they, you know, they're young ladies, right? They met Gabby when they were, you know, eight, you mm-hmm. know, around 8 years old. And they were typical stepdaughters,
mm-hmm.
you know, it could be kind of crappy to their stepmom. Mm-hmm. That was very typical. And my older daughter in particular, Claudia, after Gabby was shot, she wrote an apology letter to her. And she didn't, it took her a long time to read it to her. Gabby was in a coma, you know, for days. And eventually she did, but then she also kept it and read it to herself over and over and over again. And she showed it to me, you know, a year later. And it was, you know, on a piece of notebook paper, and it was looked like the thing was 100 years old.
Yeah.
Because she just read it to herself. And it was an apology letter. And today, both of my daughters have a fantastic relationship with their stepmom, with mm-hmm. Gabby. And, you know, sometimes out of really horrible things, you know, good things can happen.
Yeah.
And you mentioned the movie, you know, Gabby Giffords Won't Back Down. I think it should have been better titled Gabby Giffords Won't Back Down and Won't Give Up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's what I really saw. You know, all the time she spent in the hospital.
And that's what the viewers see in that film, which is pretty remarkable. I have to tell you, one thing I was reminded of watching that film was that you were going on what would be your last mission into space.
Well, if this didn't happen, it might not have been my last mission. It was going to be my last mission on the space shuttle. And I was the commander of Space Shuttle Endeavor.
And there was a launch that was scheduled for Florida. And President Obama went there. And in part, he went there because he knew that Gabby was going to be there. And they had seen Gabby right after she was shot in the hospital. There was footage in the film of that. But the reason I bring this up was he told me, I had lunch with him the day after he saw you guys in Florida. And all he could talk about was how inspiring it was to see Gabby, because when he came back from Tucson, he had said, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know where this is going. It doesn't look good.
Right.
And the thing that made it more remarkable was that as we were sitting there having this conversation, a guy from the NSA came in, said, hey, could I have a word with the president? And he asked me to step out.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy did. I was not working in the White House at that time. I had gone back to run work on the campaign. But it turns out that as we were having this conversation about her, he had given the order on Osama bin Laden.
Bin Laden, yeah.
And so he was getting an update on this. But mm-hmm. this was the thing that he was wanted to talk about.
Yeah.
You know, watching her, and she still struggles with, I saw her a few months ago in Chicago with aphasia, which is the inability to speak.
Yep.
As in the thoughts that you're thinking, and also sometimes to receive information. Yeah.
Hers is more the transmission side.
Yes.
She understands everything.
Yes, that's clear.
Yeah.
Where I was going was, I was wondering, you know, your colleague John Fetterman
mm-hmm.
came to the Senate. He had had the stroke. He has the other issue, which is the reception and how he hears words. Have you had a chance to talk with him? Has she had a chance to talk with him about these struggles?
Yes, both of us. So his, you know, stroke is in an area of the brain called close to what's called the Wernicke's area, which is the reception of speech.
Mm-hmm.
And Gabby was shot from about 3 feet away with a 9mm round right in the middle of the left side of her forehead. But the bullet went either through or next to what's called the Broca's area, which is the transmission part. So that's why she has that type of aphasia. And, you know, he struggles with, you know, he could read stuff. You know, I'm on a committee with him and you'll see him walking around, you know, with an iPad. And, but, you know,
that translates for
him. Yeah, the auditory reception, you know, for him is a challenge. So they kind of have the opposite, you know, issue.
So what did you tell him? What did she tell him?
You know, that over time and with work that, you know, this you can improve. And, you know, I've seen that in Gabby. I mean, even today she does, you know, speech therapy, you mm-hmm. know, to prepare for when she has to give, you know, some remarks, especially. But even, you know, we're now 12 years after her injury, she still improves. There's not big leaps anymore, but you can see gradual improvement with hard work. And I'm sure my colleague will see the same.
He must have been comforted to hear that.
Yes.
One other thing I want to say about that whole sequence was that I was reminded about by the film as well, was the vote that she came back to cast. The first vote she came back to cast was actually quite relevant right now because she came back to cast a vote on the debt ceiling. She thought it was that important.
Yeah. And it was the thought was it could be that close, that it could go one way or the other based on one vote in the House of Representatives, and she was just out of the hospital. I mean, she'd been out of the hospital maybe for a couple months and still doing intensive outpatient therapy. But she, you know, she's there to represent her constituents and knew it was the right thing to do, and she was going to show up at work.
Did you have an opinion on that?
Well, she's the boss. And, you know, she was a member of Congress, and I 100% was supportive mm-hmm. of this decision.
You were right there by her side as she journeyed there. I should take this opportunity to say we're right here again. I
right
talked
back.
About how much
yep.
things change.
Yeah.
But in Washington, things often don't. We're right back where we were in 2011. Do you have confidence that this thing, as you say in your old profession, is going to land?
It has to. I mean, it would be catastrophic to the U.S. economy, and it would have, I mean, it could be catastrophic for the worldwide economy to not do this and to default on our debt. And I mean, just to think about what this would mean to, you know, folks in Arizona and across the country. I mean, seniors potentially not getting their Social Security checks, veterans, you know, veterans' health care. You know, in the past, I've delivered Meals on Wheels. I don't recall a single one of those seniors that I met that I ever felt didn't need this lunch and dinner that I delivered to their apartment or house. That would end, or could. You know, the same thing with, you know, lunches and schools for kids. You know, think about the folks we'd have to lay off across the government. I mean, I'm struggling and working really hard to make sure we've got the right technology and support to Border Patrol and to the nonprofits here. We potentially would have to lay off Border Patrol agents. You know, I think we got a crisis now. I mean, that would be a horrible thing for the state of Arizona and the country. So,
fair to say you're going to have to vote for some stuff you don't like, though.
That's very possible. Uh-huh. Yep, and I think it's likely that. And you know, often I think you know, if everybody's unhappy, you know, that could be, you know, what we're going to have to accept to not default. When the country went through this in 2011, you were there in the White House. You know, I think the difference then was most members of Congress or all realized defaulting was not a good option. My sense is that's changed. And there's members, my understanding, there's members of the House of Representatives that, I mean, it's small numbers. But
well,
you heard the former
president say on television last week that, you know, it wouldn't be that bad.
It would be devastating to our country.
Yeah.
So, I could not disagree with Donald Trump more.
Yeah.
And it's almost hard for me to believe that a former president of the United States does not understand that.
Really? In this case?
In this case, especially a guy who was in business.
Well, especially a guy who argued when he was president that we shouldn't go there.
But, right. And you know, so maybe he doesn't really believe it. Maybe he just decided to say it. But it is dangerous for a former president to say those things.
So that was an aside I wanted to have. But just returning to your journey, when that horrible assassination attempt happened to your wife, 19 people shot, 6 killed, the whole nation was shocked because we hadn't seen that kind of political violence.
Well, my understanding is, you know, Gabby is the first woman who was in elected office in history of our country where there was an attempted assassination against a member of Congress.
But now, you know, just the other day, Jerry Connolly, a member from Virginia, a deranged guy, apparently deranged, came into his office with a metal baseball bat and assaulted 2 of his staff members, was looking for the congressman. One, an intern who was just starting, which is so tragic.
Yeah, how heartbreaking is that?
Well, I mean, the young girl who came to...
Christina Taylor Greene.
9 years old, came to meet her congresswoman at this Meet Your Congressman event that Gabby regularly held.
Yeah, she was 9 years old and had very, you know, high-minded ideas about service and democracy. You know, not typical of a 9-year-old, and just wanted to meet Gabby and ask her a question.
Yeah.
And, you know, for her life to be ended there so short, and then to see this happen over and over again in our country, it's just
Well, the concern tragic. I have is that it's becoming more commonplace, that our language is more incendiary, that our politics are more polarized. And I guess my question to you is, how do we break this mad cycle? Because it seems like the incentives are misaligned. Like, outrage is rewarded. Mm-hmm. You know, if you run a cable company or a social media platform, or if you're a politician trying to raise money, outrage sells.
I didn't have to do the outrage thing, you know, and I refused to do it. And you know, I think it's important to look for moderates on both sides of the aisle and elect them. And the folks that are just throwing bombs across the aisle, getting on, you know, cable news and, you know, saying radical and disturbing things is not healthy for our country. I've got colleagues in the United States Senate, Republicans, who I work with all the time, who I really like and respect. There are a good number of them. And, you know, the same with Democrats. And we have to work harder as a nation, you know, to find folks that just want to bridge the gap and work together and accomplish things. We have so much potential as a country. You know, I'd much rather be born here in the United States of America today than anywhere else on the planet. We're so good at solving problems. You know, lately our politics have become divided and heated. We can fix this, and I ultimately think we will. But it comes down to folks getting involved and not accepting and not think it's okay some of the stuff we see, you know, on cable news, and organizing and working together, both Democrats and Republicans. I mean, I am not a partisan. And, you know,
you vote substantially with your party. It's not, you're a Democrat for a reason.
I can't even tell you the statistics about how I vote. I make all my decisions on how I'm going to vote on anything based on what is in the best interest of Arizona and the country.
We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back with more of the Axe Files.
This podcast is supported by Sleep Number. Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores? Sleep Number does that. Only Sleep Number Smart Beds let you each choose your ideal comfort and support, your Sleep Number setting. Sleep Number Smart Beds learn how you sleep and provide personalized insights to help you sleep better. All Sleep Number smart beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. Temperature-balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number 1 in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Jon Stewart is back in the host chair at The Daily Show, which means he's also back in our ears on The Daily Show Ears Edition podcast. The Daily Show podcast has everything you need to stay on top of today's news and pop culture. You get hilarious, satirical takes on entertainment, politics, sports, and more from Jon and the team of correspondents and contributors. The podcast also has content you can't get anywhere else, like extended interviews and a roundup of the weekly headlines. Listen to The Daily Show, Ears Edition, wherever you get your podcasts.
And now, back to the show. Arizona is a easier place to, as competitive a battleground as it is, it's, you know, the politics that you just recited, which I know you deeply believe, are also, this is an easier place to advocate that. If you come from a deep blue state or a deep red state, if you come from a deep blue district or a deep red district, you never face a general election in earnest. You're only facing primaries. And in primaries, those loud voices have extra weight.
Right. Well, and we did this in states to ourselves collectively through gerrymandering of House districts. I mean, why did we make that decision, right? So, I mean, parties benefit, Democrats and Republicans benefit from having these, you know, easy congressional districts to run in, and it drives people to the fringes. And I think we have to continue to look for ways to make competitive House races the norm across the country, not just like, I don't know what the number is right now, when Gabby was serving in the House, or there were about 40. You know, at a 435, that doesn't result in a House of Representatives that has an easy time working together.
Yeah. States are problematic, too. You, as you know, you only get very few of your colleagues serve in states where a presidential candidate of the other party has carried that state. So we live in an era of great partisanship. Part of it is cultural. And I want to get back to an issue that sort of is a through line through some of these, our discussion here, but guns. And you're an interesting guy to talk about this issue because you're the son of two police officers, career military. You've been at war. You know a lot about guns. Gabby knows a lot about guns, mm-hmm. and had, I think at one point, a very high rating from the National Rifle Association, mm-hmm. for the position, yep. she took. Now you've seen the other side of it. How do we stem that tide? We talked about the tide of political violence a little bit, but what about guns? You know, this kid with the AR-15 and, you know, people, you know, the young man who shot Gabby had a semi-automatic handgun. What do we do about all this?
Well, in some places it's easier to buy an AR-15 than it is to, you know, adopt a dog from a shelter.
And what do you think about that? Because those weapons were actually designed for war.
They were, to kill a lot of people in a short period of time.
And they work.
They work very well. And to own one, you know, there should be a much higher standard. And if we had universal background checks, that would raise the standard. You wouldn't be able to go to a gun show and buy an AR-15 without a background check. You can do that in a lot of states, including the state of Arizona right now. So that's one obvious change we could make that would reduce the number of AR-15s that get in the hands of people that shouldn't have them.
This is a politically fraught question. So I know that when I ask, and I'll filter the answer accordingly, but
right.
Why do people need weapons that were designed for war? Why do citizens need those weapons?
Well, I think it depends on the person. Some people would, you know, who are supportive of the Second Amendment, like, you know, I am, but folks would make the case that they would need it for protection. The evidence, there isn't a lot of evidence that anyone has ever used an AR-15. There's some cases, a few cases, that they've used it to protect themselves or their families.
Very scant evidence of that.
The numbers are very low. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's not a good argument. Some people like to collect, you know, weapons. Some are former members of the military. My belief is that an AR-15 or a weapon like it should not be in the hands of people who are not incredibly responsible, who had a background check, where there's a higher standard. It's now one of the most popular guns in America.
It's a triumph of marketing.
It is. And the marketing of that weapon is a problem on mm-hmm. its own. And if you think, you know, that it's bad here right now in the United States, you know, this could get a lot worse. So, you know, my wife's out there working on this issue every single day. You know, I worked on getting that bipartisan Safer Communities Act across the finish line mm-hmm. in the Senate. We got it passed. It's a good step in the right direction. We need universal background checks. We need red flag laws in states, not just what we have with, you know, funding. If a state wants to do a red flag law, we need a national red flag law. And there's other things we can do. And I continue to have these conversations with my colleagues in the Senate, including Republicans, on what more we can do. Because, I mean, I have a two-year-old. She's not two yet, nearly two-year-old granddaughter. She has had her first lockdown in school already. I mean, it's daycare. I have a colleague whose 10-year-old grandson in Michigan just a couple weeks ago had a lockdown. Kid doesn't want to go to school anymore.
Yeah.
I mean, this is...
When I was a kid, we used to do, you know, these drills for nuclear attacks.
Duck and cover, right?
Duck and cover.
I think I just missed that.
Yeah. But we never had a nuclear attack.
Right.
You know, this is now, turn on the news, and there's a pretty good chance on any given day you're going to see something that is chilling for a kid who's having to do these drills. I mean,
And these kids are going to, a lot of them will wind up with PTSD from it.
Yeah.
And
in Chicago, these kids are experiencing it. And by the way, a lot of these young gang members in Chicago, one of the former gang members told me, look, if you don't have a gun that shoots, you know, at least 30 or 50 rounds, you're considered inadequate on the streets these days. And this is what these young kids are living with, and their parents are worried about them coming home from school. So to your point before on, you know, some people like to collect these weapons, and we do have a Second Amendment and so on, but you couldn't go out and buy a bazooka. You couldn't go out and buy an automatic weapon.
Right.
You couldn't. So where do you draw the line, and why is the line drawn here?
I think it's drawn where we are today because of money and politics. You have a gun lobby with incredible resources that worked hard to get a bunch of folks elected. You've got, you know, folks on the other side that are trying to get sensible gun legislation passed. That's happened. You know, hundreds and hundreds of sensible bills in dozens of states.
Yeah. You're the organization that you helped found.
Yep.
And the organization that your wife runs, Giffords, has been very instrumental in a lot of these battles.
You know, she continues, you know, to focus on this issue because it makes our country stand out in the worst of ways. And for kids to have to go to school and worry about a mass shooter coming through the door. And I can't tell you how many times I've sat down with parents where their kids were shot in school and died. And it is just heartbreaking. And it's devastating. After Uvalde, you know, parents sitting in my office in the Hart Senate office building who were just in a state of shock over what just happened to their child. And we shouldn't have to, you know, live in a country like this. And we need more compromise on this issue. We need, and the American people, you know, there's a bunch of common sense solutions to this that most Americans support.
Yes, and that's the thing that's most maddening is that we're a democracy. A majority of Americans have an opinion on this, and yet it's, you know, it's like moving a mountain to pass a, you know, it was meaningful but small, a step forward as you describe it. And, you know, that was a landmark because something happened.
First time anything was done in 30 years, and it wasn't easy, but it was bipartisan.
Yeah.
And it provides a lot more funding for mental health, funding for states that want to expand red flag laws. It will affect folks that traffic in firearms and who are in the business of selling firearms with regards to background checks. So it'll expand the number of background checks. So there's a lot of good things in the legislation, but folks on you know, recognize that we have to do more.
Let me ask you, now that you are a politician, whether you plan to be or not.
Well, I don't like to think of myself like that. I feel like I'm still the commander of the space shuttle, and you know, I like to, you know, think about my days flying off of an aircraft carrier.
That's another thing I could look up here if I were a better podcaster, the definition of politician. But I think you probably qualify now, whether you like it or not. When is this issue? It has always been considered a voting issue on the Republican side. Do you think we're reaching a point of critical mass? This is becoming a voting issue. That, because that's what moves politicians. I mean, I'd love to believe that everybody goes to Congress and they're motivated by nothing but good intentions and the things they want to accomplish. But job number one for most members of Congress is staying in Congress, and therefore elections become important. Have we reached a point of critical mass on this issue?
Well, I think the American people, especially moms, suburban mothers, want something done on this. And, you know, even in, you know, red states. And that's why we were able to accomplish something with 15 Republicans.
I thought it was very interesting that Mitch McConnell blessed this effort and voted for it.
Yeah.
Because I think he recognized this train coming down the tracks, which is the one that you're mentioning here. I just, you know, I'm just telling you, it's driving me nuts. It's so sad. And it's the futility of it. Every time one of these mass shootings happen, and every time one of these shootings of young people happen in a city like Chicago, every time a suicide by gun happens, which, you know, is more frequent here than anywhere else, because we have 46% of the privately owned weapons in the world.
And we have 4% of the population.
Yeah.
Yes. That's a problem.
All right. Well, we're probably not going to solve this during this hour.
We will definitely not solve this.
But I feel better talking about it. Well, I should ask you one thing related to both these questions, which is radicalization in the military. You, as a career military officer, must be sensitive. You're on the Armed Services Committee. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not a gigantic percentage, but it's an inordinate percentage. And among veterans, we saw it at the January 6th insurrection and so on. What should be done? First of all, why is it? And secondly, what should be done about it?
I spent 25 years in the United States Navy. I mean, I love being in the Navy, and I wish I could be in the Navy some days instead of on Capitol Hill,
you know,
flying off of a ship. We've got the best Navy in the world, the best military, even today. I mean, we have the most effective, professional, capable military force this planet has ever seen. You know, I mean, today. And we're going to continue. I'm going to work on the Armed Services Committee. You know, that's one of my top priorities, mm-hmm. is to make sure that if we ever get in a fight with one of our adversaries, that we are as prepared as possible to win. And we would win those today. I think, you know, in any organization, the size of the United States military, you know, we're going to have folks on the fringe. And those other things you mentioned, you know, media being one, social media. You know, there's an opportunity to, you know, pull people off in a direction and down a rabbit hole. And that happens in any organization of
that
size.
You're also drawing disproportionately from populations that may be more susceptible to it. And I don't mean conservatives, but...
you know, I mean, we've got a lot of stuff to fix in this country. And one is we need a bigger population of folks that can serve in the military.
Yeah.
When you consider the folks that can pass the physical fitness test, pass the medical exam, and can pass the reading test, essentially, that's what it is, the ASVAB, to get in the military, that number has shrunken over the years.
Yeah.
We've got a recruiting problem right now, especially in the enlisted ranks. Mm-hmm. We do not want to go to, you know, mandatory service. That's one of the reasons why we are so effective. We have all volunteer force.
Are there strategies, though, to fight radicalization?
Yeah. I mean, Secretary Austin is focused on this. You know, some folks will say it's a huge number of people. I don't believe that. I think it's small numbers, and DOD has a strategy to figure out who these folks are and then address it.
Let me turn to some other topics. because of your role as an astronaut, you're very focused on science, technology, and so on. You've talked about looking at the atmosphere from space and climate and so on. One of the things that I was reading this morning was a piece that from a few days ago about parents. This will be related, trust me. Parents who are now resistant to their kids, to mandates for childhood vaccinations, for childhood disease, you know, things that we've been treating with vaccinations forever. And that's why we have low infection rates of these things. A third of parents now say they don't believe in these mandates. And it just goes to a larger thing, how we react to climate, the climate challenge. So the competition between politics and science, when science properly deployed, has such a capacity to save us, to save lives, to save the planet, to make the future more secure. Do you worry about that?
Yeah, I worry when people don't believe in science, you know, because science doesn't care when people don't believe in science. It's going to happen anyway. And to not vaccinate your children is a big mistake. You know, we have saved, I mean, one of the reasons why, you know, over, you know, decades that people live longer, one of the biggest reasons is vaccinations. And you stop vaccinating, you know, children, they're going to die at a younger age, and then, you know, spreads through, disease will spread through a population and takes us back in the wrong direction. And to have folks out there that are respected, that are advising their parents not to get vaccinated, is a big problem.
Yeah. What about science generally? You know, we talk about climate science, for example, which for the longest time, now I think people are conceding as we deal with the extreme weather and so on that, yeah, maybe this is real. But, or, you know, and there's a hostility among various constituencies, some for good reason, because the changes that are required fall disproportionately on them. If you, if you're from the energy sector or so on, but
well, in the Senate today, I can't think of a single individual that doesn't believe that our planet is changing because of greenhouse gases, because of what we put into the atmosphere. I've seen this planet change over a decade. I flew my first space flight in 2001, and my fourth in 2011, and I remember on my first mission, getting out of my seat on the first day, looking out the window, getting a really good view of the Earth for the first time, and looking straight down, and we're over South America, and I could see this big copper color river just winding through the jungle. It's like no other river on the planet. It's really impressive. A decade later on my fourth flight, same spot. What do you think you notice? It's not the river. You notice the deforestation. Massive deforestation. Where'd all that carbon go? Up in the atmosphere. You know, if we don't do something about this, well, you now spend a lot of time in Arizona. Mm-hmm. By the end of this century, Phoenix, if we stay on the business as usual plan, Phoenix will have twice as many days over 100 degrees as it does today. Think about that for a second. Mm-hmm. I mean, we got a lot of days over 100 here. It is hot. Mm-hmm. So the thing is, first of all, folks, you know, listening to this podcast, believe in science. I believe in science. I'm one of only three engineers in the United States Senate. We do science really well, peer-reviewed, you know, studies. You know, our country is really good at this. We don't get it right 100% of the time, right? And it's, you got a hypothesis and you do your experiment and you make conclusions. You know, sometimes those will be modified. For the most part, we get it right. And it's important that we listen to experts on this.
We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back with more of the X-Files.
The Assignment with me, Audie Cornish. Celebrities of all kinds are speaking publicly about their therapeutic trips, so to speak. It turns out there is a burgeoning industry ready to serve the new influx of people who find themselves turning away from traditional mental health therapy. The gap between what we know and what we don't about psychedelic therapy. Listen to The Assignment with me, Audie Cornish, on your favorite podcast app.
And now, back to the show. Let me raise a related issue around, which is important around here, which is water. And I know you're very, very active on this issue. The Colorado River supplies much of Arizona's water, California, Nevada.
It's about 38% here in Arizona.
And it's drying up, and this is a huge concern. But, you know, you read, there was a story the other day about this, 88% of this water is for agricultural use. Mm-hmm. And obviously we need food, it's important and so on. But my question is this, first of all, is that equitable, the distribution of water? And are there ways in which science can be helpful here in developing more sophisticated irrigation systems? Are there ways also in which the market should be allowed to work? Like, should we be deploying 3.5 gallons to make one almond, you know?
Yeah.
Aren't there some hard questions that we have to confront?
Yeah, I mean, like anything, it's about choices. You said 88%. In the state of Arizona, it's about 80% goes to agriculture. Mm-hmm. Remember that that agriculture here in the state of Arizona, a lot of it's in Yuma County. If you're eating green, leafy vegetables in the winter, in the spring, anywhere on North America, it probably came from this one county, Yuma County in Arizona. Agriculture is so important for this state, for the Southwest. One of the reasons is with the climate we have, we can grow a lot of food. It does take water. In the Inflation Reduction Act, I was able to add $4 billion for this water crisis. We're now deploying that money, you know, very effectively, and we're going to be able to conserve water. We're also going to do system conservation, which is drip irrigation, lining canals, other technology. You talk about science helping here. This is the science that is going to help. It's going to be a shared sacrifice. A lot of the deal on this, because of who gets how much water. The reality of the situation is we've said there's 15 million acre feet of water in the Colorado River every year, and we've been using more water than there is. So we've got to be able to live within our means. We can't let Lake Mead get to Min Power Pool and then Deadpool. We've got a little time. The water managers of
these
states.
Are you confident that we're going to get there?
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. That and the bipartisan infrastructure bill. I worked to get $8 billion for Western water infrastructure in there. We're going to get there. And I want to just give a shout out to, you know, the head of reclamation and the water managers like Tom Buschotsky here in Arizona, who have worked really, really hard at this.
The other issue, obviously, that Arizona feels disproportionately is the immigration issue. We're now coming through this. You were not supportive of moving away from this Title 42. The change in policy that discontinue the Trump era border policies, but we're now there. Mm-hmm. The administration says it's gone better than expected. What is your sense of where we are, and how do we solve this problem, which obviously requires a great deal of resources and the willingness to deal with it on a grand scale, not just piece by piece scale?
Well, Title 42 was implemented as a public health emergency provision. The public health emergency has ended.
Right, yeah.
And, you know, my goal with the administration was to make sure that they came up with a plan that they could operationalize.
Are you satisfied with the plan?
Well, Border Patrol, CBP, the nonprofits in southern Arizona, not speaking for the other states, have done a really good job with coordination and communications with Homeland Security. The sector chiefs, Chief McGurk and Chief Modlin, have done a very good job here over the last couple months. They've worked together really well, and they have managed this. Now, having said that, we still have like really high numbers. This falls on especially mayors, Mayor Nichols and Uish. So the mayors in southern Arizona, in Yuma, Douglas, Nogales, they've got a really tough job. And this is unfair for people that live in these border communities. Border Patrol needs, you know, funding, more Border Patrol agents. We need more technology at the border. In some places, we need barriers. And then the thing you allude to is comprehensive immigration reform. Could be incredibly helpful to our economy. It's the right thing to do.
Maybe essential to our economy.
Possibly, yep. And it's the right thing to do. We have 800,000 dreamers in our country that really just grow up here.
So given the nature of Congress today, what are the odds of this? You know, in 2013, comprehensive immigration reform passed by a wide margin in the Senate and never got a vote in the House.
And last Congress, towards the end, we were getting close. And we're going to continue to work on it. It is one of the most frustrating issues, especially when you consider that in the state of Arizona, I meet these young people all the time, you know, that came here when they're 2 years old and have to live with this uncertainty in their lives that they one day could be deported. And it's really heartbreaking.
Yeah, and
they're
contributing here.
They're as American as my own two kids.
Yeah. Well, I mean, look, as a matter of economics, we're growing at a rate in which if we don't have an infusion of immigrants, we're going to pay an economic price for that. We're educating people from around the world and then sending them back to compete against us. This is an insane policy.
I agree. That's why we need a – that's why we call it comprehensive, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I talk to farmers and ranchers all the time. They need more work, bigger workforce. They've got limits on H-2A visas. They would like to have more. You know, the folks in Yuma County especially. I mean, that workforce comes across the border every day and then goes back. But if you're trying to run a hotel somewhere, you're often getting this workforce from overseas, even in the areas of, you know, in healthcare with nurses. I mean, we could really benefit by expanding the number of visas for nurses to work in nursing homes and hospitals.
Which is a critical shortage, direct care workers, nursing home workers, huge problem for the country.
And I'll tell you what, we don't want to turn into, you know, some countries that have declining populations. Mm-hmm. We need to grow our economy. If you're a CEO in the country today, I have not met a CEO that isn't having a hard time finding the workforce. Mm-hmm. I mean, it could be, I'll be going over to Boeing later today. Mm-hmm. Last time I was there, I was talking to the CEO of Boeing where they build the Apache helicopter, mm-hmm. finest attack helicopter in the world. I had an opportunity about a year ago to fly it, brand new one, had the new helicopter smell. A lot of fun to fly the Apache for me as a former test pilot. I don't have a lot of time in helicopters, but talking to the CEO about just, you know, how these are really good paying jobs, building Apache helicopters, you know, how is it finding the workforce? And she said, it's really, really hard. And I said to her, I said, yeah, you probably have a hard time getting people coming out of the military that are airplane mechanics to build these Apaches. And she said, no, you don't understand. We'll take anybody. Hmm. I mean, we'll take somebody out of high school if they'll come here and if they can, you know, just, you know, pass a drug test, mm-hmm. and they want the job. And these are good paying jobs.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's we've got to be, you know, thinking forward. The other challenge we have today is like in semiconductor chips.
Yeah.
You know, we passed, you know, my legislation mm-hmm. to expand semiconductor manufacturing, mm-hmm. you know, here in the country, a lot of that is going to come here to Arizona, tens of thousands of good paying jobs. What we need and what we're working on is, you know, having the pipeline through community colleges and universities and even like maybe straight out of high school and into some two-week program that then qualifies you to interview for TSMC, to Intel, to get these mm-hmm. great jobs that do not require a four-year degree.
Real quick, Ukraine, you've been over there. Your impression of where this war is at, where are we and how much time do they have?
I was there about a month ago. I met with Zelensky for over an hour, but then even more time was with his national security team, the deputy prime minister. I'll say President Zelensky is very grateful for the weapons that we've provided and the assistance.
Should we be providing more? What about the F-16?
I'll get to that in a second. Mm-hmm. But, you know, he's also frustrated. I mean, this is existential for them. I mean, the day that while I was in the meeting with him, He brings up that one of the Ukrainian POWs, captured by the Russians, had been decapitated, and we hadn't heard about it yet. I mean, just the war crimes that Putin has committed is we haven't seen this in anything at this scale in decades. And my goal is that he and others are held accountable for this and that he loses. We're at a critical point here,
yeah.
Right? I mean, there's going to be a counteroffensive. We don't have the details. I don't exactly when that's going to be and where and how this is going to be conducted. We've provided them with, a tremendous amount of military capacity, weapon systems that military in Ukraine has never had before, right? Artillery systems, HIMARS, other
Patriot systems, yeah.
Yeah, Patriots, weapons that they can put on their airplanes. And then we get to the question of F-16s. I've spent a lot of my career, flying airplanes like the F-16. I've flown the F-16 a number of times. I used to fly the F-18. I was a test pilot. I flew in combat. It's not a howitzer. It's not even a tank. It's going to be hard for them to maintain them. I think we need to look for the path to train not only the air crews, but the maintainers to get them a modern air force. Flying a squadron of F-16s into Ukraine and turning them over to them doesn't work.
How does this end?
How does this war end? I mean, I think ultimately it's going to end in some sort of negotiation. And my hope is, Putin makes a decision that he can't win this thing. And it's in his best interests and his country's best interests, though I don't really think he cares so much about the country. He really cares about himself, that it's in his best interest to stop this. He is murdering, women and children every single day.
Yeah, no, plainly. But a negotiation also entails two parties.
It does.
And that's hard for Zelensky after the butchery that you describe. Is what's important in the next few months getting as much territory as back as possible in order to give him leverage in that negotiation?
Yeah, I think so. And, right now the Ukrainians are doing well. They're getting, new tanks. They're going to be deploying the M1 here soon. They're getting longer range surface-to-surface missiles from the UK. This is going to help. They're also suffering battle damage on a lot of the weapons that we've given them. We're trying to help them maintain and repair these systems. I saw some stuff over there that that's very unique to this fight with how we've been able to deploy technology and helping them at the front line repair a howitzer like you would normally do. And previously you would have to send this stuff back to depot level kind of maintenance.
They're doing it in the field.
So they're rather
so
innovative.
Just to put a button on this. When do you think this negotiation will come?
I can't give you a date.
But this offensive is critical.
Yes, and it is very critical. And if this doesn't go well for Ukraine, my fear is that Putin and his cronies can just continue to throw more mass at this, meaning people and stuff. They've got a bigger population. They've got a bigger army. They can conscript a lot of folks. They don't seem to care about the guy on the ground, and that's why, you'll see days where the Russian military on a Saturday lost 1,000 soldiers. I don't think Putin cares, and he can continue to throw stuff at this.
Yeah.
And when you have, a bigger country and a bigger population, often in these kind of conflicts, mass wins.
Yeah.
But not always. Not always. I mean, the history of our country proves that. Just from the founding of the United States of America, it proves that the smaller force that's smarter and, willing to innovate on the battlefield can win not only battles, but can win the war.
I have to ask an indelicate question. Gabby Giffords left Congress because she felt like she couldn't give it her all. And there are all these questions about your colleague, Senator Feinstein, just revealed that it wasn't just shingles that she had, but encephalitis as a result of it. I know that decorum probably requires you to say that she should continue as long as she feels she can continue. But is that right? Is that fair? I mean, it's you're not going to expel her, so it's the reality. But shouldn't this be a concern if people are serving who can't fulfill their responsibility?
Well, I think it's important to recognize that she returned. When my wife was shot, she was in a similar situation. Mm-hmm. And Gabby was in the hospital for 6 months. And I felt it was important for her to make her decision. And she did. We got to October, November. I think it was just before Thanksgiving. I remember sitting on our couch. I was still living in Texas. We hadn't moved back to Arizona yet. And she was still really struggling with her aphasia. And we're watching TV, and she asked me to mute the TV, and she just said that she would like to resign.
Mm-hmm.
And it was totally her decision, and it was hard for her. I mean, she loved serving in the United States Congress. I'm sure Dianne Feinstein loved being in the Senate. That's why she's been there so long. I think this is a decision that she will have to make with the folks around her. People that she's close to. And at some point, I'm sure she, like anybody who serves in Congress, at some point they make a decision that it's time to move on.
I'm not going to ask you about the Arizona Senate race coming up because...
Thank you.
Yeah, well, I don't want to make you dance unnecessarily here because I know you know, this is a delicate situation with Senator Sinema. But I do want to ask you about you.
Yeah.
You mentioned earlier that the... that there are days that you wish that you long for the military, and I'm sure the orderliness of that life is quite a contrast with some of the nuances of politics. I'm being
very different. It is about as different as you could get.
But you know, your name comes up from time to time as someone who in the future could actually run for president. And I know I listen to you here. And you sound very plausible in that regard. Is that something that you would consider at some point in your life? Or maybe I should ask the more artful interviewer's question. Would you rule that out?
First of all, let me ask you this.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know how I got here? Like, how did I wind up, like, even running for the United States Senate?
We covered that in detail.
Not really. So, I mean, it goes back to the election in 2018. You know, I was Gabby and I were at this Get Out the Vote effort in right at the Van Buren here in Phoenix, music venue, listening to the Gin Blossoms. And this woman comes up to me. She was not much older than my eldest daughter, she says. She's standing next to me because I'm pointed mm-hmm. at the stage. And she says, "Hey, my son has Down syndrome, and I'm terrified that he's going to lose his health insurance.
Mm-hmm.
Would you please consider running for the United States Senate?"
Mm-hmm.
And I told her I would, meaning I would consider it. And that's when I started really seriously taking a look at this. I don't rule anything out, but when I, you know, hear that, I think, okay, we've got a war in Europe right now. We've got a crisis on the Colorado River. We've got challenges at our border, trying to get all this infrastructure money, you know, adequately deployed. Often this time of year in Arizona, we start to have wildfires that we've got to deal with. Senator Romney and I have been working on that.
Mm-hmm.
We've got problem after problem. We've got to avoid default. So I'm focused on doing this job right now. Like I was in the Navy, flying off of an aircraft carrier, you know, flying into Iraq on combat missions. I'm very focused on what I'm doing then. You know, flying the space shuttle. You know, I had to do that my last mission while Gabby was in the hospital. I'm rendezvousing with the space station while she's getting brain surgery. So I
was that when
been,
you decided this is it?
Well, I just knew because of the severity of her injury, I wasn't going to go and train in mm-hmm. Russia to go be the commander of the space station,
mm-hmm.
which I would have considered doing. I also thought about maybe just trying to stay in the Navy
mm-hmm.
and continue, see if I can go, maybe take that next step and get back into the operational part of the Navy.
Mm-hmm.
Love being in the Navy.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm always focused on the job that I'm doing today.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I thought that was an artful answer. But I so appreciate your time. It's good to be with you. And good luck with all of those challenges that you just listed. People want to see progress.
Thank you, Max. We, there is no country in the world better at solving hard problems than the United States. I'm convinced of it. I mean, we're the folks that sent people to the moon in the 1960s. We can solve these problems. We can make a brighter future for our kids and our grandkids. We can tackle climate change, water here on the Colorado River.
Yeah, if the politics will allow us.
It will.
All right.
I'm convinced.
I feel better. I'm going to go off with a bounce in my step today.
All right. Hey,
Senator,
thank you for having me on.
Great to be with you.
And good
thank
to be back on your show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Axe Files, brought to you by the University of Chicago Institute of Politics and CNN Audio. The executive producer of the show is Miriam Finder Annenberg. The show is also produced by Jeff Fox and Hannah Grace McDonald. And special thanks to our partners at CNN. For more programming from the IOP, visit politics.uchicago.edu.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.